Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
First, Tyler's going to talk to you briefly about the main topics we plan to cover today, and then we'll go into more detail as we walk through each of these issues.
Good morning, everyone. This is Tyler Gerking, and I'll give you a brief outline of the areas that Gary and I are going to discuss this morning, and I think we'll talk for about 45 minutes and then allow some time for questions, and you can also type in your questions to us along the way. The first topic that Gary is going to touch on relates to considerations for an entity that appears to be close to insolvency or in insolvency, and what issues it ought to consider with respect to its insurance coverage. Second, Gary's going to talk about the automatic stay that applies after an entity has filed for bankruptcy, and then we'll get into the specifics about the effect of the automatic stay on the entity's insurance coverage, as well as the risks associated with violating the automatic stay. Then we'll talk about problems that could arise as a result of losing insurance coverage in bankruptcy, that is, not taking steps to preserve the debtor's insurance policies while it is in bankruptcy. And then I will talk about the specifics relating to D&O liability coverage in bankruptcy, specifically with respect to directors and officers' rights to the proceeds of a D&O liability policy that the entity, the debtor, purchased before it filed for bankruptcy. Then I'll talk about, in particular, the insured v. insured exclusion and how that can affect the availability of insurance coverage for directors and officers after the debtor is filed for bankruptcy. And then Gary will finally address some ancillary items relating to insurance coverage and bankruptcy, and we'll end the presentation there and take questions. So right now I'll pass the mic, so to speak, to Gary, and he will talk about pre-bankruptcy considerations.
Thank you, Tyler. Yes, you know, there's a number of things that folks should be aware of with respect to insurance coverage of an entity that is in distress or near bankruptcy. And being aware of some of these things and acting proactively ahead of time before a company goes into bankruptcy can often help protect rights that folks have or hope they have with respect to the distressed company's insurance coverage. So first, it makes sense to be aware of some of the risks that are likely to occur with respect to insurance coverage of a distressed company as it enters into bankruptcy. And we're going to get into these a little bit further as we move along, but some of the bigger ones, as Tyler made reference to earlier, is
joining conference.
A real risk of losing insurance coverage if there's not planning proactively before a bankruptcy case is filed to ensure continued coverage during the bankruptcy case. And there's also a risk of running afoul of what's known as the automatic stay in bankruptcy and being sanctioned for that if one is not aware of those rules going forward or prior to a bankruptcy and planning accordingly. There's also, because of the risks that certain coverage won't apply in bankruptcy, there's also things that one can do, and we're going to get to, in terms of planning ahead of time as to what policies say and what exclusions apply to policies before a company files bankruptcy, and making changes to the policy accordingly if you know a company's in distress and may very well file bankruptcy. And then the other thing to keep in mind, we're going to talk about the automatic stay in bankruptcy in a moment, but one thing that you can do ahead of time if you know a company is going into bankruptcy is to plan for relief from the bankruptcy stay right after the bankruptcy case is filed to allow uninterrupted insurance coverage or at least a very minor disruption to insurance coverage once the bankruptcy case is actually filed.
So one thing to add there before Gary goes on, one step that could be taken before a bankruptcy is filed is the purchase of a renewal policy if it appears the policy will terminate shortly after the bankruptcy case is filed. I'll talk about this a little later, but a decision by Judge Montali here in the Northern District of California in the bankruptcy court in the Heller law firm bankruptcy highlights this issue. In that case, the law firm's professional liability insurance expired shortly after the bankruptcy case was filed, and Judge Montali decided not to allow the law firm to purchase an additional policy to cover liability claims against the law firm and the attorneys post-petition. And as a result, the law firm and the attorneys were left bare, so to speak, without insurance coverage for those claims. And that issue could have been addressed before the bankruptcy was filed by renewing or extending the term of that professional liability insurance policy. So now Gary is going to talk about the automatic stay.
Yes. Thank you, Tyler. That actually is one of the points that we really wanted to make sure we stressed here is maintaining continuous coverage. So first, before explaining the automatic stay, I think it makes sense to just lay the groundwork for some bankruptcy basics so that it will make a little bit more sense how the automatic stay applies in a bankruptcy case. When an entity or company files bankruptcy, by operation of the bankruptcy code, all of their property rights become part of the bankruptcy estate. And those include obvious things like tangible property as well as intangible property, such as insurance coverage. And once a bankruptcy is filed, the bankruptcy trustee essentially takes control over all those assets. Now, in a Chapter 11 case, the debtor itself, the entity that filed bankruptcy, is its own trustee, although an independent trustee can be appointed under certain circumstances. But that trustee essentially controls all of the property of the bankruptcy estate, but that authority is limited by some rules in the bankruptcy context. The bankruptcy code does not allow the trustee, which again can be the debtor itself, the company itself in a Chapter 11, to enter into transactions that are outside the ordinary course of its business without getting approval of the bankruptcy court. So, for example, things like buying additional insurance coverage or renewal coverage, like Tyler just pointed out, are things the bankruptcy court must approve as being in the best interest of the overall bankruptcy estate. Now, one of the things that happens immediately upon the filing of a bankruptcy case, and it's typically one of the main reasons why an entity will file bankruptcy in the first place, is that there's a statutory injunction that automatically applies once the bankruptcy case is filed. It's called the automatic stay. This is pursuant to Section 362 of the Bankruptcy Code, and the automatic stay prohibits any action against either the debtor or the debtor's property interest. And that is very broadly defined so that the automatic stay is as broad as one could possibly imagine, and it includes things like the debtor's contract rights that are considered to be property rights, including insurance coverage, and those are all protected by the automatic stay. So the automatic stay then has some direct implications for a company's insurance coverage once it files bankruptcy, and we're going to get into a little bit later the specifics of some of the rules that apply in certain types of insurance, like Tyler's going to talk about director and officer insurance coverage, which has some unique rules to it and under the case law. But speaking generally, the automatic stay would apply to any rights or interests that a debtor has under its insurance policy, again, with certain exceptions and qualifications. And the automatic stay also would therefore generally prevent collection of any pre-bankruptcy judgment against the debtor's insurance policies. Again, this is property considered property of the bankruptcy estate. In addition, the automatic stay also usually or almost always prevents an insurance beneficiary from pursuing claims against the insurance policy that benefits the debtor company. And the automatic stay also generally prevents officers and directors from getting coverage for their defense costs and their liability for actions taken while being a director or officer of the company.
And that may depend some on what kind of D&O liability policy the debtor purchased, and I'll get into that in more detail in a few minutes.
Right, and the as a matter of law, at least in our circuit, the Ninth Circuit where California operates, any actions taken in violation of the automatic stay are deemed to be void, meaning it's as if they never happened. In some other jurisdictions, those actions taken in violation of the automatic stay are voidable, meaning unless and until someone tries to undo them, they're still valid. Now, it's pretty serious if one violates the automatic stay, and as we'll learn in a few minutes, it can be pretty innocent. But if somebody violates or goes against the automatic stay, they can be sanctioned by the bankruptcy court through the bankruptcy court's contempt power. They can be liable for any damages caused by violating the automatic stay. They can be liable for attorney's fees and other legal expenses that result from the violation of the stay. And this liability can be substantial, as you might imagine, because one particular action violating the stay can have ramifications that end up costing a lot of money. So the best way, of course, to avoid violating the automatic stay is to make sure you get appropriate relief from the bankruptcy court to at least either not have the stay apply or get a determination that the automatic stay is not applicable in certain situations.
And one key aspect of the automatic stay is that it's viewed as being an injunction issued by the court, even though it arises automatically upon the filing of the bankruptcy case. So one's violation of that injunction could lead to a finding that the violator is in contempt of court. And a bankruptcy court has power to impose civil contempt sanctions. It can't impose criminal or penalty-like sanctions, but it can impose civil sanctions, which include coercive sanctions or compensatory sanctions. And a coercive sanction could include an order which applies daily fines until the violation is abated, or even imprisonment, if imprisonment is found by the bankruptcy court to be something that could coerce the violator to comply with the automatic stay. And in addition to defending claims for violation of the automatic stay, the violator could be liable for, quote, compensatory contempt sanctions, which would include the legal expenses of the party seeking to prove the violation occurred or to cause the violator to abate the violation. So it can become a very expensive undertaking for someone who has violated the automatic stay to get out of the trouble they've created. So one has to take a lot of caution in trying to avoid running afoul of the automatic stay. And when we start to talk about some of the rules that apply to insurance coverage, it'll become clear that that the rules themselves are unclear, and it's difficult at times to determine what you can and can't do without court permission. So it's really important to look, to study, think about what you're going to do with respect to an insurance policy, and then get some advice as to what is or is not permissible before going ahead with any action.
Thank you, Tyler. And because the risk, indeed, can be so great, usually if one cannot determine whether or not the automatic stay applies, it usually makes sense to go into bankruptcy court and ask for the court to find that the automatic stay does not apply, or to the extent necessary, the automatic stay is lifted to allow the particular conduct that you're trying to do, rather than risk all these potential penalties for violating the automatic stay. So there's two primary ways that one can get relief from the bankruptcy stay. It can either be done by an agreement or by a formal motion with a hearing. What often happens in the insurance context is that it's done by agreement, and what will typically happen is the party that's seeking coverage of an insurance policy will approach the bankruptcy trustee and ask for an agreement that the insurance can be pursued as long as the entity that's seeking the insurance does not also go after the debtor's own assets, in other words, other than the insurance coverage. And that sort of agreement is very common in the liability world, and typically bankruptcy trustees are willing to do that if they understand that the other property of the bankruptcy estate is not being affected by this. And typically the bankruptcy court will rubber stamp an agreement of that sort, whereby both the trustee and the party seeking the insurance are getting relief from the bankruptcy estate for this limited purpose of just pursuing the insurance rights. Now, one other thing that often happens, and Tyler will get into this in a little more detail when he talks about director and officer insurance coverage, is that there's a limited pie for the insurance coverage that covers both liabilities and defense costs up to a certain level. And because of that, there's often dispute as to who's going to get how much of that pie. So in the case of, for example, director and officer insurance coverage, the agreement for relief from the automatic stay to allow pursuit of the insurance coverage may cap or limit how much coverage particular folks, let's say particular directors and officers that are being sued, how much of that pie or how much of that coverage under the policy they're entitled to, and that relief will be limited accordingly, so they can't essentially use up all the policy or you know, disproportionate share of those policies. And that's often one of the key issues in both trying to get a stipulation or an agreement for relief from the automatic stay, or when one pursues a motion for relief from the automatic stay, is putting some sort of limitation on how much the particular party can get of the insurance coverage when looked at in context of all the folks that are protected by that coverage. Now, Tyler's going to talk about in a little more detail now the director and officer insurance coverage.
Yeah, and first I'll step back, I think, even further and describe insurance coverage in general to be clear about the issues that arise in the D&O context. You know, generally there are two types of coverage. You can either have third-party liability coverage or first-party property coverage. The first-party property coverage would protect the beneficiary under the policy against a loss to its own interest in a particular piece of property that would be caused by a covered peril. And I'll talk a little later about creditors' interests in first-party property policies. And a third-party liability policy would cover the...
Joining conference.
Matt Lewis.
Would cover the insured under the policy for its defense costs in defending a claim against it, as well as for its liability for any settlement or judgment that it would incur after defending the case. Certain liability policies, such as a commercial general liability policy, otherwise known as a CGL policy, will commonly pay defense costs in addition to limits. That is, if you have a policy with a limit of $1 million, the insurance company will be obligated to pay an unlimited amount of defense costs in defending the insured against any litigation. That is, if the defense costs could exceed the $1 million cap of the policy without exhausting the limits of the policy. Only liability payments would exhaust, indemnity payments would exhaust the limits of the policy in that scenario. There are other policies, such as D&O liability policies, which are often what we call wasting policies. That is, defense costs paid on behalf of an insured under a wasting policy would reduce the limits of liability of the insurer So if you have a $20 million D&O liability policy and the defense costs of a particular insured reach $5 million, only $15 million are left under that policy to pay for other insured's defense costs or their liability. That's a key distinction when we get into how the interests and the dynamics interplay when a D&O liability policy is at issue in a bankruptcy case. So in bankruptcy, generally, where a debtor is an insured under an insurance policy, we'll take a liability policy for example, the policy itself is property of the estate. That's well settled in the Ninth Circuit and other circuits. The issue arises in bankruptcy about whether the proceeds of that policy, that is, the money that the insurance company is going to have to pay out under that policy, whether those proceeds are property of the estate. And as a general rule, if the debtor, the company that has filed for bankruptcy, has a direct interest in the proceeds of the policy, those proceeds will be considered to be property of the estate. And as a result, because the proceeds are property of the estate, they're subject to the automatic stay. And to the extent any other insured under the policy has a right to those proceeds, they may risk violating the automatic stay by trying to obtain those proceeds without court permission. The flip side of the coin is where the debtor has no direct interest in the proceeds of the policy. So while the policy itself may be property of the estate, in this circumstance, the proceeds may not be. This would arise in the circumstance where you have what we call a Side A only directors and officers liability policy. That's a policy that covers only the defense costs and the liability of the directors and officers. It does not cover any defense costs or liability of the debtor. Where the debtor has no interest in those proceeds, they may not be property of the state, and they may be pursued even without court permission. So let's take, for example, a simple CGL policy, which most, if not all, companies have in some form or another, where you have a third-party claimant pursuing a claim against a debtor. The pursuit, that is, the defense of the lawsuit, will not erode the limits of the policy because the policy pays defense costs in addition to limits. And also, to the extent there is liability of the debtor to the third-party plaintiff, that liability will be paid by the insurer to the extent the liability is covered under the policy. There, bankruptcy courts will often allow claims to be pursued against the debtor where there's an agreement that the plaintiff will only execute on a judgment, execute against the insurance policy and not any other assets of the estate. That's been allowed in a number of different cases. There's one called In the Matter of Edgeworth in the Fifth Circuit, and there's also a Ninth Circuit BAP, and that is a bankruptcy appeals panel decision from 2007 called In re Benz, where claims were allowed to be asserted, that is, the permission was given by the bankruptcy court to pursue claims against the debtor, where the claims would only be pursued against the debtor's liability policy. The question about whether a claim can be pursued against the debtor or a director or an officer, or the director and officer's rights to the proceeds of a policy, becomes trickier when you're talking about a D&O liability policy, because those are wasting policies. And so every penny paid under a D&O policy, generally speaking, will erode the limits of liability. So I'll get into now various rules that could apply to D&O liability policies when the debtor, that is, when the named insured, the named entity insured, has filed for bankruptcy. So first I'll talk about the types of D&O liability policies that a debtor could have purchased before it filed for bankruptcy. First, the debtor could have purchased a Side A only policy. That is a policy that covers only the defense costs and liability of the directors and officers. I referenced that type of policy earlier. You can also have a D&O liability policy that covers only the entity's liability or defense costs. That we could refer to as either a Side B or a Side B and C D&O liability policy. And the Side A and the Side B and C, those are phrases reference the insuring agreements within a D&O liability policy. So you can have policies that cover only directors and officers. You can have policies that cover only the entity. And you can also have D&O liability policies that cover both the officers and the directors on one hand, as well as the entity on the other hand. Now, because the automatic stay applies to proceeds of an insurance policy where the debtor has a direct interest in those proceeds, the cases of the issues of whether the automatic stay applies to proceeds of a Side A only or a Side B, C only policy applies, those are pretty easy cases. Under a Side A only policy, where the directors and officers are the only ones that have any rights to the proceeds of the policy, those proceeds should not be subject to the automatic stay, and the directors and officers should be able to access the proceeds of those policies without seeking relief from the bankruptcy court. On a related note, creditors committee or another plaintiff could not move to compel the bankruptcy court to enjoin the distribution of policy proceeds to officers and directors and officers under a Side A only policy. Now, under a Side B or C policy, where the debtor is the only insured that has a direct interest in the proceeds of the policy, those proceeds are subject to the automatic stay, and no one can take action against those proceeds, that is, try to collect those proceeds, without relief from the automatic stay. The more difficult case is where you have a Side A, B, and C policy. That is a policy that covers both the directors and the officers, as well as the entity. And this is a sticky issue because of the competing interests in this wasting asset of the estate. Because you've got the entity, to the extent it has any potential liability or even the potential of a lawsuit being filed against it, or the potential that it would have to indemnify any directors and officers for their own defense costs to the extent they were sued, the entity has a strong interest in preserving the assets of that D&O policy so it can use them. At the same time, if the directors and officers are defendants in a lawsuit and they're not being indemnified by the company, they will want to have immediate access to that policy to pay for their defense costs. For example, if you have some securities litigation where defense costs can run into the millions or tens of millions of dollars, individual directors and officers are going to want insurance for that. I mean, they're not going to want to wait around to see whether the company is going to ultimately be the subject or the defendant in any later claims. So you have a fight over who gets to access these policies. Now, there are two competing views in the circuits about whether the proceeds of a side ABC policy, D&O liability policy, are assets of the assets of the estate. The Ninth Circuit has not really resolved the issue. It is hinted that the proceeds of a side ABC policy could be estate property, but it hasn't explicitly held that. And in fact, there was a Ninth Circuit BAP decision, BAP being the Bankruptcy Appeals Panel, from earlier this year in January 2010. The case is called In Re Mila, Inc., Mila being spelled M-I-L-A. The site is 423-BR-537. And there, Judge Montali, a bankruptcy judge from the bankruptcy court here in San Francisco, stated that the Ninth Circuit had not explicitly determined whether proceeds of a side ABC policy are property of the estate. But he concluded that in this particular instance, a director should be given relief from the automatic stay to access the proceeds of the policy where the entity had only a remote or hypothetical right to the policy. That is, where the entity claimed that it might have to indemnify other directors and officers, but it couldn't identify any specific claims that were being asserted against other directors and officers, which it might be required to indemnify. And it also couldn't identify any specific claims that could be asserted against it, the entity. And therefore, its claim to the proceeds of the policy was hypothetical, and the court concluded that it should allow the director who was the defendant in a pending case access to that, to the proceeds of that policy. Now, some courts have found that while the proceeds are estate property, because you have competing interests in the proceeds from both the entity and directors and officers, the proceeds should be divided among the debtor and the directors and officers, either on a per capita basis or in proportion to the liability faced by each of them. So you could, depending on what court you're in, you could have either a first-come, first-serve approach to collecting under the D&O policy, or you could have a court say at the outset of the case, look, I think Director A is going to be exposed to the tune of $1 or $2 million in defense costs and liability. Director B is exposed to maybe $5 million, and the entity is exposed to $10 million. So I'm going to right now make a determination that Director A is entitled to $1 million under the policy, Director B is entitled to $5 million under the policy, and the entity is entitled to the rest. And in that circumstance, to the extent Director A's liability exceeds $2 million, he or she may not have coverage for that. So that's this distinction between whether proceeds are property of the estate or they're not property of the estate is a big one. And depending on what court you may be in, you'll want to look at the issue very closely to determine at the outset how to approach the case and how to argue for your own interests and get the coverage or the amount of coverage that you think you should be entitled to. In any event, under a side ABC policy, regardless of whether it appears that some of the proceeds of the policy may not be subject to the automatic stay, you're going to want to obtain relief from the automatic stay with the bankruptcy court or reach an agreement with the trustee in advance before making a claim on the D&O liability policy, because you just don't know what arguments could be made about whether the proceeds should belong to someone else, either the entity or another director or officer, and you don't want to run afoul of the automatic stay and find yourself possibly subjected to contempt sanctions for violating it by reaching out and grabbing estate assets that you may not be entitled to, or at least the bankruptcy court might not view you as being entitled to. Now, one solution to this problem, that is the problem that arises under a Site ABC policy, is to purchase Site A-only coverage before any bankruptcy is filed. And Site A-only coverage, from the carrier's perspective, it's one of its primary purposes is to cover directors and officers in the bankruptcy context. So if you have Site A-only coverage and you're a director or officer, you should be protected to the extent you've got liability that's covered by such a policy. Now, because the proceeds of a Site ABC policy may be estate assets or may be construed as being estate assets, third-party claims against directors and officers, where those claims would be covered under that particular D&O liability policy, could be stayed as well, where a plaintiff is pursuing, a third-party plaintiff is pursuing a claim against directors and officers, and the directors and officers will seek to access the D&O liability policy. The bankruptcy court might stay that third-party litigation to avoid depleting that wasting asset of the estate. That happened in a case called In Re Circle K Corporation in the bankruptcy court in Arizona. The site there is 121 BR 257. There are sort of multiple ramifications of the automatic stay and how it interacts with a Site ABC policy, and to avoid any ambiguities there, you may just want to insist on getting a Site A-only policy to cover the directors and officers' liability.
And just so we can explain one aspect of that decision, the Circle K case, the reason the court found that the third-party claims might implicate the bankruptcy estate is that by the insurers paying under those policies, they essentially had reimbursement or subrogation-type claims back against the company for that liability that they paid out. And that, of course, as a claim against the bankruptcy estate, potentially diminished the pot available to other creditors of estate assets. And that's why the court found that the automatic stay was implicated, because the debtor's property rights were indirectly affected.
And that issue obviously wouldn't arise if you have a claim by the debtor, directly by the debtor or the trustee, against directors and officers, where the debtor or the trustee have made the determination that pursuing the claim is worthwhile for the estate. Those claims can be pursued and won't be stayed. The next I'll talk about the one exclusion that seems to be implicated most commonly by the filing of a bankruptcy, and that is the insured v. insured exclusion that's found in pretty much every D&O liability policy, as well as other types of policies. Such as professional liability or E&O, errors and omissions liability policies. And the insured v. insured exclusion bars coverage for claims by one insured against another. So where you have the company pursuing a direct claim against a director or officer, the D&O liability policy generally will not cover that claim. And there's an exception to this insured v. insured exclusion for derivative shareholder derivative claims, where you have a direct claim by the entity against a director or officer, the insurance company will not pay for the director officer's defense costs or liability. And the initial rationale for the inclusion of this exclusion in the policy is to avoid providing coverage for potentially collusive claims where, for example, the entity has a loss and it wants to pursue a claim against a director or officer to recover for that loss, and it colludes with the director or officer in pursuing that claim for the sole purpose of recovering the insurance asset. Insurance companies don't want to pay for that. So this insured be insured exclusion exists in the policy. And when the entity files for bankruptcy and either the debtor in possession or the Chapter 11 trustee pursue claims against a director or officer, the issue arises as to whether the debtor in possession or the bankruptcy trustee are, quote, insureds under the policy that would trigger the insured be insured exclusion. So the question is whether a debtor in possession or the Chapter 11 trustee are insureds under the policy, or at least should be construed as insureds under the policy for purposes of the insured be insured exclusion. And the courts are split on this question as well. And in fact, it's very murky even in the Ninth Circuit right now. There is a sort of seminal case out of the District of Delaware federal court called Alstrin. And there, the Delaware court found that the insured v. insured exclusion did not bar coverage for claims by a bankruptcy trustee against a director or officer of the debtor. And there are really two reasons. I give two reasons for its conclusion. The first is that the exclusion was intended to bar collusive claims, and a claim by the bankruptcy trustee against a director or officer is not generally going to be a collusive situation. And also, the bankruptcy trustee or the debtor in possession are not, they're not the same entity as the pre-bankruptcy debtor. That is, the trustee or the debtor in possession represent the interests of all the debtor's creditors as well as the shareholders, whereas the entity going into bankruptcy, that is, the entity before bankruptcy, is its duties are to the shareholders. So the court found that the trustee and the debtor in possession are not the insured under the policy, and therefore a claim by either one of those against the directors or officers of the debtor should not trigger the insured v. insured exclusion. So a defendant, director, or officer who's been sued by the trustee should have coverage under a D&O liability policy. The Ninth Circuit reached a similar conclusion in the case called Unified Western Grocers, Inc. In 2006. The site there is 457 F3rd 1106. But there has been a more recent decision by the Ninth Circuit in a case called Biltmore Associates, LLC v. Twin City Fire Insurance Company. Case came down in 2009, I think it was mid-2009, and the site is 572 F3rd 663. There, the Ninth Circuit held that a claim by the debtor in possession against the director or officer triggers the insured v. insured exclusion because it found that the debtor in possession shouldn't be treated as a different entity than the pre-bankruptcy debtor. It didn't specifically, the court did reference the Unified Western Grocers case, but it didn't explicitly overrule that case. So it's a little unclear, in the Ninth Circuit at least, as to whether claim by bankruptcy trustee as opposed to the debtor in possession would trigger the insured v. insured exclusion. Now, there are things that one could do before a bankruptcy is filed to protect against the risk that the insured v. insured exclusion would apply to claims brought by the debtor in possession or a Chapter 11 trustee against a director or officer. Some D&O policies will accept claims that are accept claims from the insured v. insured exclusion that are made on behalf of a bankrupt entity. And actually, the exclusion can spell out exactly who claims can be pursued by and against. For example, insured v. insured exclusion could say that it will not apply, that is, there will be coverage for claims by a creditor's committee or a trustee or a liquidating committee or a debtor in possession. So to the extent one could negotiate that sort of exception to the insured v. insured exclusion pre-bankruptcy, it could be potentially very valuable for the directors and officers who may face claims after a bankruptcy is filed. Similarly, some insurers will expressly include claims by the debtor in possession or the trustee in the insured v. insured exclusion. And those types of exclusions are, like any other, many other policy provisions, are subject to negotiation with the insurer. So if it appears that you're buying a policy that would expressly exclude coverage for claims brought by a debtor in possession or a trustee, that's something that you might want to attempt to negotiate with the insurer, and it may be worth paying a little extra money up front to get that coverage to protect the directors and officers after a bankruptcy is filed. Now I'll turn it over to Gary to talk about some final issues with respect to coverage and bankruptcy.
Thank you, Charlie. I'm going to try and run through these quickly so that there's an opportunity for folks to ask questions if they have any. First, some other key issues that can come up in terms of insurance coverage in a bankruptcy include so-called vanishing coverage, and we alluded to this earlier. And this is the concept that if a debtor does not either renew its policy or buy so-called tail coverage for its insurance policy, then the insurance can expire during the bankruptcy by its own terms. And like we pointed out earlier, the bankruptcy court may not authorize the company to spend the money to buy more coverage. So folks may think that there's insurance coverage there, but it turns out there's not. And that's the sort of thing that if you're a director or officer or you're someone that is a third party planning to be covered by the insurance, you want to make sure ahead of time that the coverage is really there and it's going to be continuing. Some other concepts relate to how a claim of an insurer itself is dealt with in a bankruptcy case. In the easier situation, if the insurer pays out a claim under a policy, it typically has a right to seek reimbursement from the debtor, from the company in bankruptcy, for paying out on that policy, and it can file a claim in the bankruptcy case for that obligation. Typically what happens is even if the payout happens after the bankruptcy, the claim is treated as a pre-bankruptcy claim for bankruptcy purposes, and this is a key point here because pre-bankruptcy claims typically are general unsecured claims that only get paid after all the secured creditors and the priority creditors get paid. Now, in a lot of cases, they get little or nothing in a bankruptcy case. On the other hand, priority claims, for example, if an insurer provides new coverage post-bankruptcy, that's considered an administrative priority claim, and that has the highest priority among all the unsecured creditors in a bankruptcy case, and they get paid right after the secured creditors get paid or get their collateral back. Now, one thing that an insurer can do instead of seeking reimbursement is it can seek what's known as subrogation, essentially stepping into the shoes of a party that it insured if that party has a claim against the debtor. And what happens is if indeed the insurer pays off on that claim, it steps into the shoes of and has all the same rights of the claimant that the claimant has against the debtor company. This is typical in the liability insurance world. So the insurer really has the choice to either do one or the other, and whether it's reimbursement or subrogation. And if they go the subrogation route, the key is to make sure that the third-party victim or beneficiary of the insurance actually filed a claim in the bankruptcy case that the insurer can, quote, step into. And there's a bankruptcy code provision that allows an insurer to actually file the claim on behalf of the beneficiary to make sure that that claim is part of the bankruptcy estate and that the insurer has the right to step into the shoes of or subrogate to that claim. I wanted to stop there and just see if any folks have any questions. If not, I'll try to wrap up and talk to you about some of our future webinars. So if anyone has a question, you please take it off mute and feel free to ask your question. Okay, hearing none, I wanted to just let you know first, we'll be sending out later today or perhaps tomorrow an email containing the program materials that we've gone over today, as well as some information about ourselves and our firm. And there'll also be a link on there to connect to some of the prior webinars we've given in case there are topics in there that interest you. I also want to briefly just tell you about some future webinars we have scheduled. First, on June 23rd, we have a webinar on opportunities and pitfalls in acquiring distressed assets. Then on July 14th, we're going to be talking about a restart technique for technology and intellectually property-driven companies. Then on July 28th, we'll be talking about some employment issues that arise for financially troubled companies. And then later in the summer, on August 4th, we're going to be talking about recapitalizing, repositioning, restructuring, or reorganizing opportunities in the wine industry. So if folks have any further questions, please ask them now. Otherwise, feel free to contact us by email individually. Our contact information will be on the program materials that are being sent out to you. We'd be happy to try and answer your questions in the future. And thank you very much for attending today's webinar.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. A lot of questions.
Yeah, really. A lot of interest. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think it went well.
I didn't drone on too much.
No.